Hi, I'm Gary LaRude, Technical Editor of Microwave Journal. Peregrine Semiconductor, now known as P-Semi, can claim credit for the development and wide adoption of silicon-on-insulator, or SOI, as a semiconductor technology for RFICs. Ron Reedy, Mark Bergner, and Rory Moore founded the company in 1990. Jim Cable joined in 1996 and became CEO in 2002. He led Peregrine through the early design wins and rapid growth as it gained share in mobile phones, as silicon-on-sapphire displaced PHEMT as the incumbent switch technology. This success led to an IPO in 2012. However, Peregrine's time as a public company was short. 2 years later, Murata, its largest customer, acquired it. After the acquisition, Jim Cable remained CEO, then became CTO, chaired the board, and served as the semiconductor R&D director for parent Murata. After some 23 years with the company, he retired at the first of the year. On January 10th, only 7 days into retirement, Jim graciously spent an hour on the phone with me reminiscing about his career and the trajectory of PSEMI. I hope you enjoy our conversation, which archives the history of an important time in the RFIC industry. Well, I wanted to catch up with you a bit before you forget how to spell SOI.
I don't think there's much danger of that.
One of the things that struck me when I was looking at your LinkedIn profile is that you got a bachelor's degree in physics.
Right.
When I went to school, the hierarchy was that physics was the toughest thing you could choose. So my question is, what led you to choose physics?
Partly that it was tough. And, you know, when I started school, I really thought I was going to be a lawyer. And so, but I did like math and science. So I kind of had a mixed curricula where I, you know, I had economics and history and that sort of thing. But I also took calculus and physics. And the first midterm I had in physics, I got an F.
Oh my gosh.
And I was a great student in high school. And I said to myself, wow, this is really hard. This is what I want to do. So, and I also felt that, you know, kind of economics and history and political science, you didn't really need a professor. You could read the book. But in physics, man, you needed the professor because it was hard to read the book. So yeah, I'd say I was attracted to it because it was difficult.
And perhaps that's been a theme through your career.
Well, yeah, I don't know about that, but yeah, I've always liked challenges, and like I say, physics was tough, and at some point in time, I sort of said to myself kind of two things. One, you know, we had all these labs in physics, and the physics labs never really worked right. You know, you'd measure gravity or you'd do something crazy like that. You almost had to dry lab your answer because you knew what the answer was, but you know, certainly the experiment didn't prove it out. But, you know, then I took some classes in electronics and those labs all worked. You build a circuit and you test it and it did what it was supposed to do. I said, well, this is pretty neat. And then, you know, I sort of came to the conclusion that, you know, I did want to go to grad school and you know, I thought, you know, getting more degrees in physics, you know, what am I going to do with that? You know, you get a PhD in physics and, you know, what are you destined to be? Probably a professor.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I flipped over to electrical engineering. And I did kind of what I would call solid state electrical engineering. So, I mean, it still had a very strong physics content, solid state physics, that sort of thing.
Right.
But, you know, I could see where it was applicable to industry. So I did care about getting a job and not being poor forever. So,
and what attracted you to semiconductors? Was there anything beyond just the fact that it was solid state physics and kind of interesting?
Well, yeah, I think it really was that. Like I said, I was intrigued by the whole electronics area because, as I say, the labs work. So it was like, wow, you can actually predict what's going on here. But I like the fact that active circuits needed these devices like transistors. And so it was, you know, it was interesting to kind of combine those two things. And so, yeah, I would say that semiconductors is, you know, I think in some colleges, actually, semiconductors are considered almost like applied physics. So, it was as close to physics as you could be in the EE department.
So you get your PhD in EE and then join TRW. What was it at TRW that attracted you?
Well, actually, I started working at TRW before I even graduated from college. So I was an intern there, and I worked full-time in the summer and part-time during the school year. You know, what attracted me again was, you know, it was kind of the only technology company that was close to where I was living and going to school. And before I graduated, I mostly did like programming for them. And it was funny because the day I finished my last final at UC Riverside, where I got my degree, my boss calls me into his office and he goes, okay, well, now you have a degree, so we have to pay you as a member of the technical staff. And I got a 55% raise one day. It was like, wow, shows you what a degree is worth.
Wow.
And then I decided I wanted to go to grad school. And so TRW had their headquarters were really down in, or their big campus was in Redondo Beach. And so anyway, I transferred down there, went to UCLA to start on my master's program.
Mm-hmm.
And there I really kind of did, again, a lot of kind of circuit stuff. And I did a bunch of transistor modeling. And again, at one point in time, I added some subroutines to SPICE, which had just come out. So I was, you know, I would say that was 1981 is when I really started kind of working in semiconductors. You know, eventually at TRW. So I did that for a few years. And then I was able to actually join their microelectronics center because they had a fairly large CMOS activity at the time. And they also had a fairly big gallium arsenide activity. The gallium arsenide, of course, the HBT technology that TRW had, you know, eventually became the basis for RFMD.
Right.
So I went there, and eventually I was the advanced technology manager for the CMOS activity. And I mean, it was an incredible team of people that, you know, we had there. And if you track their careers going forward, it's really quite amazing. Before, I was kind of just like, as I said, I was really good at the device physics side of things and the modeling side of things. But when I went there, you know, I began to really learn a lot more about the processing side of things, you know, how you did process development, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Because, you know, you don't learn that in school very well. So then TRW decided to get out of silicon. You know, they basically came to the point where they said, we can't afford to be doing silicon and gas. Gas is more strategic to us for our internal satellite programs, so we're going to shut down the silicon activity. So, you know, they said, well, you know, you can do something else here. You know, we'll put you on some other assignment, you know, be a program manager or something like that. And I just decided that, you know, I would stick around long enough to finish my PhD, because I did my PhD over a 12-year period, believe it or not.
Wow.
Because I was working full-time. And there would be times along the way where I would just say, I can't do this. And I would take a year off, and then my advisor would eventually convince me to come back. So I finally decided. So I think it was in 92 when I finally finished it. And then I said, okay, I'm going to leave TRW and get back in, because there was no semiconductor future for me there. And that's what I wanted to do. By that time, I was pretty hooked on the whole semiconductor business. I eventually ended up at Hughes technology center in Carlsbad. And I have to say that, you know, I had plenty of other choices, but frankly, I'd always wanted to move to San Diego. I never had found a way to have a good job there. I wasn't so enamored with the place, but, you know, I was enamored with being able to live here. And I remember we used to surf like 6 days a week when I was at Hughes Technology.
Oh, my gosh.
It was 10 minutes to the ocean. So we'd go at lunch. I mean, it was crazy. But after probably a year, Hughes Corporate decided to shut that down. And they wanted to transfer sort of the key technologies that they used internally to the, they also had a fab in Newport Beach. They asked me to come up to Newport Beach and run the technology development team there and, you know, transfer the technologies. And I did that. And then eventually they said, okay, we want you to take over operations. So, you know, that was interesting because I was running the fab and, you know, then I got the chance to learn about things like 24-hour shifts and maintenance and pushing the team on getting their yields up.
All the fun things.
Yeah, all the fun things. So, you know, when some of my guys sometimes go, we should get a fab, I go, no. No. Been there, done that. So, and then Peregrine offered me the job. And I kind of could see the writing on the wall at Hughes Newport Beach. I felt that it was only a matter of time before they decided to shut that down as well. And so here again, Peregrine offered me the chance to get back to San Diego. I'd always been interested in Peregrine, and kind of an interesting story. I knew the company when it was first founded. So the history there is that the core technology, the core SOS technology was came out of the Navy lab here in Point Loma. Ron Reedy and Mark Bergener, who were two of the three founders, you know, were at the Navy lab, and that's really where they kind of perfected the SOS process. So they left the Navy and started Peregrine, but they needed somebody to build wafers for them. And, you know, it's not easy to go to a fab and say, run silicon on sapphire. And so somehow they got my name. I didn't know Ron or Mark from Adam, but again, I was the advanced technology manager for TRW. So somehow they tracked me down and they came and taught me all about what they were doing in SOS and why SOS was so good. And, you know, would we run wafers for them? I had come out of the technology development team there, and I asked one of my guys to get involved in this, and we looked at it and we convinced ourselves that sapphire really wasn't going to be a contaminant. So we actually took one of our existing CMOS mass sets. It was like probably 1.2 micron geometries at that time, 4-inch wafers. And Peregrine had 4-inch SOS wafers. So we just ran them through the fab and got really good results. I mean, it was not that difficult. So they tried to hire me at the time, and they were kind of focused on digital applications. You know, in theory, SOS could be really good for things like memories and FPGAs, but I didn't feel that, you know, that was a business opportunity that really made sense. So I said, no, I'm not going to join. And plus, as I said, I was probably 1990 and I was still finishing my PhD. So I wanted to get that done first. But in the meantime, one of my guys came to me and he said, he was a guy who had come from Russia and he'd done RF semiconductors in Russia. And he came to me and he said, you know, Jim, silicon on sapphire is very interesting. He said, it's not interesting for digital stuff, but it's really interesting for RF. He said, I measured S parameters last night. And I didn't even know what S parameters were. He said, it's really good. I mean, it has a high FT and a high, I mean, it has the FT that's the gate length, but he said the F max is really high. This is really interesting. And it was about that time that, you know, in universities, professors were starting to look at RSC MOS. And, you know, because up to that point in time, there were certain products that were gas, and there were other products that were bipolar. But, you know, guys at Berkeley and UCLA were starting to look at RSC MOS. And it was clear that the transistors were okay and had the performance needed, but a lot of the problems were due to the substrate. Mm. And so I kind of got pretty interested in that. Like, well, what if you did CMOS, but you put it on an insulating substrate? And so in 96, Ron called me back. And at Hughes has probably made more silicon on sapphire circuits, at that point in time, than anybody else. And they're in all the GPS satellites and a bunch of the other satellites that are up there. And my team at Newport Beach build those things. And I mean, these were big digital chips and we could yield them fine. So I was convinced that SOS was manufacturable. And so when Ron called me, I said, they were just trying to move it into a foundry in Japan and struggling a bit. And I said, well, I'm 100% certain that, you know, we can get it into production because we did it at Hughes. And I said, but, you know, what is your business strategy, you know, product strategy? And he goes, we're going to become an RF company. So I said, okay. So that's why I joined Peregrine. Like I said, I'd been intrigued for a while. So that's when I finally jumped ship and went there and got back to San Diego and haven't been out of San Diego since.
When you were at TRW, did you have a choice between gallium arsenide or silicon, or did it just happen that you ended up on the silicon side?
I would say that before I transferred into the Microelectronics Center, I was doing a bunch of work with the silicon guys and really nothing with the gallium arsenide guys. So I'd have to say that it was the silicon guys that offered me the job. Mm-hmm. It's not to say I couldn't have transferred into the other group because I knew those guys as well. But, you know, I was perfectly happy to be a silicon guy. I mean, it was exciting.
So at Peregrine, they declare they want to be an RF supplier.
Right.
What was it that convinced you that SOI would be a good technology that could displace gallium arsenide, particularly on the switch side?
The first thing I would say is that the real reason for doing RF in SOI is that you can integrate. You know, if you looked at a gas switch solution back then, you know, you needed a negative voltage because it's depletion mode. You needed blocking capacitors. So the solution was, I would say, you know, the gas switch itself might have been pretty small, but when you had to wrap all this other stuff around it, it wasn't that small. And so, you know, if you looked at the R on C off of gas, it certainly was better than what we had in SOS at the time. And, you know, gas had the advantage of higher breakdown voltages. And, you know, we invented the idea of you stack SOS transistors in series and, you know, you can achieve the same breakdown voltage because the voltage is shared across all the transistors. And then I believe that, you know, Moore's law would eventually improve the performance of those SOI transistors. And we entered the market with an R on C off that wasn't competitive with gas. It wasn't that far behind, but it wasn't great. And that was half micron technology, and it was about 75 or 750 R on C off. And through scaling and Moore's law, our current generation is 75. So 10x reduction. And if you plot R-on-C-off improvement in gas over those years, it would be on a much, I don't think it would have gone down very much at all. So again, it was that, you know, Moore's law works.
Yeah.
It just really does. So we, you know, we exploited that, you know, and then we had to tackle linearity. And in particular, when 3G came along, they wanted to meet this intermodulation spec. And it was, we couldn't do it. Nobody could do it. The gas guys couldn't do it either. Sony figured out how to do it eventually with their gas by putting this whopping charge pump on it and just driving the gate really hard. But we came up with we finally got to, I mean, we spent a year on this, figuring out why the IMD on these SOS, which was still all SOS at the time, why it was so bad. I mean, why it couldn't meet the spec? Because we couldn't come up with a physical explanation of, we thought it should be really, really good. And then we eventually did figure out what the reason was, what the physics of it was, and how to fix it. And that's a concept that we call HARP, harmonic, what is it, H-A-R-R, harmonic reduction. I don't know. I can't remember. It was so long ago. And that's a core piece of Peregrine IP. And you couldn't do SOI switches today without HARP. I mean, it was an absolute breakthrough. So with that, you know, we really began to capture market share. It just kind of got crazy. So I think it's probably like 2007 when we entered the market.
Mm-hmm.
We had met Murata, like in we went to Nokia, and we showed Nokia the, you know, the switch performance, and or we said we can build GSM switches in silicon, and they laughed and said, no, you can't. We gave some samples, and they went into their labs and they tested them, and they say, well, you know, you don't quite meet the spec, but you're pretty close. And so you're close enough that they said, we don't buy discrete switches from people. We buy modules. So we'll put you in touch with our biggest module supplier. And we had been trying to get into Murata. We knew they were a big module supplier, and really they wouldn't give us a time of day. Well, when Nokia called Murata and said, you should take a look at Peregrine, well, that changed the game. So, and they, Murata kind of looked at us and said, you know, we're not really sure that, you know, you can do this, but if you can, it could be pretty disruptive. So I think it was 2006 when, you know, they actually did a small equity investment in us, and they funded us to do some custom switches for them. And they began slowly to start designing those switches into their modules for what I would call third tier customers and handsets, because they, rightly so, they kind of knew our supply chain was not incredibly robust. And then over the years, they continued to get more confident that we could do it. And so we would get into second tier OEMs and second tier handsets. And then eventually they were confident enough that they started designing us into Samsung phones. And then finally they started designing us into Apple phones. So it was a long period of time, but, you know, step by step, they brought us along.
Quite a ride.
Yeah, quite a ride. So there were some tough meetings during that era, let me tell you. Your part doesn't work.
And where in that process did you do the IPO?
So we did the IPO in August of 2012. And, you know, we had just been designed into some really, really big phones, and in fact, multiple sockets in some really big phones. So it was pretty clear that our business was going to be really good, and it was predictable. And so it was a good time to go public, because they say the most important quarter after you go public is, you know, you meet your numbers. And we sandbagged a little, and we met our numbers. And so that was great.
Right.
Being a public company CEO is that's a tough job.
Like sort of being a fab manager.
It's worse. Fab manager, public company CEO, you have your employees, you have your customers, and you have your investors and Wall Street and analysts. And, you can't say anything because, it has to be full public disclosure, and you can't miss your numbers by a penny. Mm-hmm. And then the governance is just insane. You've got your audit committees and your comp committees. And, oh man. But anyway, we did that. And it was about that time where we started looking at SOI. And I would say the reason was that with SOS, you were limited to really kind of 6-inch wafers. And, it appeared that like 8-inch could be done. The Sapphire guys could do 8-inch, but there were no real other markets. Whereas 6-inch, a lot of the blue LED guys were using 6-inch Sapphire. So it was bringing the prices down pretty dramatically. And we tried to run 8-inch wafers, and we were using Oki. Mm-hmm. That became Lapis, part of Rome. They were convinced they could run technically 8-inch Sapphire, but it just looked like a big undertaking. And if you have a 6-inch wafer, it's really tough for a fab to do below quarter micron. So kind of our Moore's Law adventure would end. So that's when we really started looking at SOI. We had done a generation of SOS, which we called bonded SOS, BSOS, and that was like normal SOS, but with much higher performance at a transistor level. And we had done that work with Soitec, so we got to know the Soitec guys really well, and the volumes were quite high, and they actually built a fab to do BSOS for us. I think that's what I'm sure that's what put Soitec on the map for, hey, RFSOI could be a nice business. And then they went out and sort of perfected this trap rich SOI, which is the basis of, what everybody's using today. And, we're using trap rich SOI on 12-inch wafers. And, mm-hmm. Our latest technology node is 65 nanometers. So again, there are some applications, but I would say very few, where the performance of SOI is not as good as SOS, but they're very few. So we still run a lot of SOS, but I don't anymore, but I did. But it's all legacy stuff. We haven't probably designed a new product in SOS for 2 or 3 years.
So what drove the decision ultimately to be acquired by Murata?
Well, we were a public company, and we had missed our numbers by, a decent amount. And I don't remember the cause of that. But, if you're in the handset market, if you're designed in with the guys in Cupertino or the guys in Korea, and you get designed out in the next generation, it hits you hard.
Yeah.
And so that kind of happened. So our stock was well below what it had been at. And I would just say that some of Murata's competitors came forward and expressed interest in acquiring the company. If you're a public company and they had offered a sizable premium over the current stock price. So when that happens, a public board really, it's hard for them to ignore. Just let me put it that way.
Right.
So when Murata had invested in us equity wise back in like 2006, the CEO asked me to let him know if there were ever a competitor that was seriously looking to acquire us, because he wanted an opportunity to, he didn't want the technology to go to a competitor. So we had kind of two letters of intent. And so I called Murat and told him about that. And I said, you know, these are credible. They've been vetted by the board. You know, the gentleman I spoke with at Murata, who ran all of their module business, he said to me, and I'd known him for, you know, since 2006, and this was 2014. And he said, you know, he said, the CEO and the CFO are out of the country today, so I don't know that I can get you an answer by today, but he goes, I'll get you an answer by tomorrow. And I thought, really? So anyway, he calls me the next day and he goes, we're going to buy you. Hmm. You know, by that time, you know, then the investment bankers get involved and you kind of have a little bit of a bidding war.
Right.
But anyway, they, you know, I, to be honest with you, I think that they would have been perfectly happy not to have bought us, because in some ways they controlled us without owning us, because so much of our business was going through them.
Right.
I think today they're very happy they did, because we've really helped their business a lot. You know, as I said, I think they did this defensively because they didn't want us to go somewhere else.
That makes sense. So as you reflect back on this long career, what kind of stands out as a high point or a low point, and what lessons did that give you?
Well, I would say the high point is doing an IPO. As one of my board members told me, who had done an IPO in his previous life, he said, you know, doing an IPO is the Super Bowl of corporate America.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, what if you're a CEO, it's like, what better accomplishment can you have, right? Because it's a tough track. So that was clearly the highlight. Probably the low light, frankly, is fairly early on after I took over as CEO of Peregrine, it appeared that we weren't going to make payroll that week.
Wow.
We had a accounts receivable that was supposed to arrive in time, but, you know, we really couldn't bet on it. My CFO at the time came to me and he said, look, you know, there's a chance we can't make payroll. And he said, I'll bring in half, you bring in half. And I said, I can't ask you to do that. I mean, he only been there like a month or two. And he goes, you didn't ask me. I'm volunteering. I just went, oh, wow. So we both brought in checks.
Wow.
And it turns out that the account receivable did come in. So, you know, the checks didn't get cashed. But, you know, I think that I learned from that don't run the company on fumes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did several more fundraising rounds, and, you know, you'd go into them thinking you wanted to raise 20 million. And, you know, if you could raise 30, you know, go for it. You know, there is this view that the valuation will go up in time. So take as little money as you absolutely need, and then do another round at a higher valuation and people get less diluted. But, you know, I'm sort of the opinion of take the money when you can get it, because the global economy can go south. And I mentor a bunch of new CEOs, and they ask me their my advice on fundraising, and that's what I always say. Just like, if you can get the money, take it, because things always cost more and take longer than you think.
Right. Take one bite of the apple, not two.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, the fundraising environment right now is pretty good, because of the strength of the stock market. But who knows, you know, next year, what it will be like. So if you got an opportunity to oversubscribe your round, do it. Do it.
Talk a little bit about your leadership philosophy. You've clearly come up through the technical ranks. You've managed the technical side of things. You've managed the operations side. Obviously, you mentioned the challenges of dealing with the investment community. If you focus on the tension between the technology that a high-tech company is trying to develop and the people on your team, how do you kind of balance those two in terms of trying to meet your milestones while sustaining your team?
I would say that, my style is fairly I'm not afraid of risks, okay? I'm not afraid to, like, take on really tough problems where there's a chance that they'll fail. And I encourage that among my team, that if we just do what everybody else is doing, we'll fail. Startups have to do something different. They have to, startup doesn't win business on the basis of price. It has to have something that gets people to want to buy it. And I was in some ways, while I'm very much a technology guy, I also really wanted to make the business work. So I kind of had this philosophy with my team that, it's okay. We're going to fail sometimes, but we got to push the envelope. We got to be out on the leading edge. We got to be doing stuff that people think is impossible. And so I wanted people on the team that kind of could deal with the fact that, maybe there'd be some failures along the way. I think that, and this wasn't sort of my culture, but I mean, I didn't invent it, but Peregrine always had a really strong, I would say, ethics with respect to quality and reliability. And, our data sheets were always conservative, and customers would say, wow, your parts are way better than you say. So we never overhype stuff. And I think that served us well. And, I feel like we always treated our employees fairly. We try to find growth opportunities for them. It wasn't an Intel where, you go to meetings and people are yelling and screaming. That's not my style. I don't like that. I mean, there's times where there's confrontations, but you can do it in a civilized way. So there's probably people out there that say I'm too soft. And okay, that may be, but that's, I find that 90% of the time that works. Mm-hmm. And I'm a big believer that if the team is cohesive, that's way more important than having a bunch of superstars who can't get along.
Right.
So.
And you measure the progress based on the ultimate execution.
Yeah. And I think, I wouldn't say I invented this at Peregrine. I would say Ron did. I continued it, and that is, quality of life is important. It was important to Ron. It was important to me. And, we didn't walk around at 7 p.m. and look at who's still working. And, we didn't come in on the weekends and check on who's working. I mean, you have professionals, when they have to work really hard, they work really hard. When they don't, when there's a tape out that they got to get done, I mean, they'll put in 24 hours, 2 days in a row.
Right.
But after that, then they relax for a while. And so we weren't slave drivers at all. It's interesting because we get that feedback. I get that feedback from employees who left Peregrine. They say, wow, we didn't realize how good we had it. So I think most people would say it's a good place to work. I mean, there's always some disgruntled people, and usually disgruntled people leave because they don't like their manager. That gets harder and harder as you get bigger and bigger. When I joined the company, I think I was employee 15. We're over 600 now.
Hmm.
In the old days, I knew every employee in the building, and I knew their wives and I knew their kids' names. And now I walk through the building, there's people I've never even seen before, much less know their names. So, which, I don't really like that, but I know that happens.
Right. That comes with growth.
Yeah. And on the topic of growth, just let me add something that all the pundits said when we agreed to be acquired by Murata that, you know, Murata was just going to take our IP and know-how, bring it all back to Japan, and that there'd be pretty much nothing left of, you know, what we'd put in place. And I said, no, I don't believe that, because A, I know the senior execs there, and I think it's just the opposite is going to happen. And that's really what has happened. I don't know the exact numbers here, but my sense is that our headcount is probably, it's somewhere between, I'm guessing 75% more than when they acquired us, maybe even more than that. It might be 100%. So we've doubled. Murata's invested massive amounts into us. And, you know, we used to just do RF for them. Now we're doing power chips for them. We're doing sensor ASICs for them. So it's really, and I would say that to 98% of the employees, the Murata acquisition was really good because it provided more stability, because obviously they're a $15 billion a year company. For those of us that have to deal with Murata a little more on the bureaucratic side, sometimes that's a little tough. But I would say for the most part, they leave us alone.
Yeah,
they trust that we know what we're doing, and well, because they've known us so long, they knew what they were getting.
Right. So as you head out the door, figuratively or literally, and look at the landscape for RF silicon, what do you see as the pros and cons, the outlook?
Well, I think that. You know, certainly RF silicon in switches is not, I'm guessing there's very, very, very few applications today where GaAs is still being used. If it is, it's because it's just kind of a legacy, you know, single pole, double throw switch that sells for 3 cents or something. And again, it turns out that most of our business now, most of our quote switch business is not really discrete switches anymore. It's switches and LNAs, and they're integrated. And I mean, there's a fair amount of logic and control. So, you know, I don't, in the sort of the receive side of a RF system, I think SOI will be dominant forever now. On the transmit side, it's a little different. Certainly for connectivity applications, Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, SOI will be a big player there. You know, we're in handsets today with Bluetooth and Wi-Fi PAs in silicon. On cellular, you know, HPTs have some advantages. I think SOI CMOS can be competitive. You know, it's not as clear that, you know, people say, well, CMOS is really cheap. Yeah, that's true on a cost per square millimeter basis. But you can make a GaAs HPT because its power density is higher than silicon. The die size is quite a bit smaller. And then, of course, for some of these sub-6 5G applications, the operators want like even 3 dB more output power. So, you know, I guess I feel like we were very, very close to launching a silicon PA before Murata bought us. But, you know, they had bought in Renesas PA Group in 2012. And, you know, we tried to work with them. And to some degree, we were kind of both trying to eat from the same rice bowl. And so we finally pulled the plug on that activity, much to my chagrin, because I still feel you can do it. But I guess I feel like today that, you know, there may be better opportunities. So I, you know, again, I think we could probably do a competitive CMOS PA with the latest technology nodes that are out there, but for cellular. But I think there's better opportunities. And then, of course, for millimeter wave 5G, My opinion is it will be SOIPAs there. And it's because of the, it's really, really important in millimeter wave to get the maximum level of integration you can do, because, you know, going off chip is really ugly. So, and, you know, scaled CMOS has no trouble doing millimeter wave PAs. Performance is very nice. We've built 45 nanometer SOI PAs that, you know, work at 60 gigahertz, no problem. And again, as long as the power, and again, for a millimeter wave handset, the powers are going to be under 20 dBm.
Right.
So I see SOI CMOS as winning in millimeter wave 5G. But in terms of displacing GaAs and cellular PAs, there's some, I think, penetration there, but I don't know that there's anybody that is going to put the effort into really doing it. And, you know, you got some pretty strong incumbents out there, so it's not going to be easy.
True. Well, certainly at millimeter wave, the other benefit for silicon is as these architectures go to phased arrays, that plays well to the per element power.
That's right. That's right. So, that, you know, I mean, people want, as I said, less than 20 dBm. It depends on who you ask, but it's not the 26 to 29 that a non-phased array approach has. You know, I've looked at the efficiencies that people are getting at millimeter wave frequencies with GaAs or GaN. And of course, HBTs don't work at those frequencies. So a GaAs solution will be PHEMT. And, you know, again, one of the advantages of HBT over CMOS was that it's a vertical structure, whereas a PHEMT is a lateral structure, so it's bigger. I don't see, you know, I think GaN for PAs has some real promise, but I mean, what OEM is going to be comfortable with a GaN supply chain? It's going to take a long time.
So as you look now to retirement, what's on your agenda? Are you going to be going back to surfing at noon every day?
Well, eventually, yeah. I mean, I just moved, and so I downsized, and so I'm trying to cram 10 pounds of stuff into a 5-pound bag, and then I had to clean out my office at work, and I had a lot of paperwork there. So I've not surfed. I've been busy doing house chores, but this is day 7 of retirement for me, and I can safely say I haven't been bored for one second of it. You know, I've been offered a CEO job, a CTO job, a number of board positions, some consulting roles, and I actually have an idea for a new company that I believe could end up being bigger than PSemi.
Wow.
But I, you know, so I'm telling everybody right now, look, I'm going to spend a month or two decompressing and thinking about what I really want to do next. I live on the 16th hole of a golf course that I'm a member of, and I look out and go, I could get good at golf again.
That's true.
But I'm going to have to stay involved in the community somehow. And I still have so many ideas, and my brain's too active to just sit on the beach and drink rum drinks, although sometimes that does sound good.
Well, when you decide to launch this new idea, please come back and tell us what it is.
Yeah, I will. I will. I was able to, I mean, one of the key things was I really wanted to assess, could it work? And so, I really pinged a lot of people I know that would be part of the ecosystem, either on the manufacturing side, on the development side, and even on the investment side. I probably have like 10 people who say, you do this, we'll join. nobody's been able to poke any holes at it. So I was talking to a friend of mine right before Christmas, and I told him a little bit about what the idea is. I said, I'm 100% convinced it'll work. I'm 100% convinced I can get the money. The only thing I'm questioning is my own fortitude to do it. And he sends me back a note and he says, fortitude can be outsourced, Jim. So, and one of my friends in the industry, because I was telling him that I was going to retire, and he goes, really? I go, yeah, I'm just going to get a hammock and lay in it and read books. So he sent me a hammock. and then he goes, I'm really not trying to encourage you. What I'm trying to encourage you is to get off that hammock. So anyway.
Well, thank you very much for sharing a lot of the memories from your career and teasing us with some new possibilities looking forward. It's good to hear you're not going to be truly retiring.
No, I can't do that. I got too much gas in the tank still.
Well, I especially appreciate now knowing that we've taken you away from unpacking your boxes that you've spent the last hour with us.
No problem. It's been a nice break.
I never would have guessed that your initial intent was to be a lawyer.
Yeah. It was. But I also had some discouragement from my neighbor was a lawyer. And he said, don't go into law. It's a crappy job. That, and I really, the classes just were... they were interesting, but they weren't hard. They weren't challenging. And so anyway, kind of a dumb reason maybe, but that's why I changed.
I think your career in technology speaks for itself. So I think you had a bigger impact doing what you ended up doing.
Yeah, I do too, actually. So I have no regrets about not being a lawyer.